Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oil is closer to $100 a barrel right now than it is to $50. But you know what? That's okay. Black gold as economic indicator today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering GoToMyPC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at GoToMyPC.com/market. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 1st of April, and it is good, as always, to have you here. Crude oil closed just shy of $85 a barrel today. That's the highest it's been in about a year and a half. And on the face of it, rising oil is troubling until you realize that maybe one reason people want more oil is because the economy is getting better. David Kirsch handles oil market intelligence for PFC Energy. David, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks a lot.
Here we are at plus or minus $85 a barrel. It has been characterized the past couple of days as a sweet spot for oil prices, you know, good enough to stimulate investment, but not so bad it crimps the economy. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, Saudi oil minister Ali Naimi went a little bit further and called it a perfect price a little while ago. And I think to a certain extent, there's a real ring of truth to that. Producers, especially the OPEC producers, are very happy with prices the way they are. And as you say, it doesn't seem to be causing a lot of problems for consumers. And in fact, you know, we had State Department's lead energy advisor coming out yesterday and echoing OPEC, saying that, you know, this is a good price range. It encourages investment. But at the same time, it's also leading to some conservation and investment in alternative energies as well.
Well, let me ask you this then, though. I mean, we've got the American summer driving season coming up. The economy is getting slowly better. That'll increase demand. How long is it going to stay sweet?
You know, I think it's actually going to be a little bit tough for prices to go much, much higher than where they are now. There's a little bit of a notion that we should get into maybe the low to mid-90s, as sort of a halfway point between the highs and the lows we've seen over the last 2 years. But I think, you know, looking at some of the broader economic conditions, the economy is recovering, but it's still at a very low level. Unemployment in the United States is still about 10%. And more importantly, when we look at the oil market specifically, refineries are not doing very well at all right now. And the reason that I point that out is, you know, the refiners are the only ones buying crude oil. And you really want high demand from those refiners to really translate into sustainably higher prices than where you are currently. So I think it's going to be a tough path to get above the low 90s this year.
Let's get it to the consumer level, though. With gas at $85, $90 a barrel, are we safe at $3.50 a gallon of gas?
Yeah, I think that's what the Department of Energy's expectation is, and it's probably a reasonable estimate for where we'll see pump prices over the summer. A little bit of a seasonal spike if demand holds up to reasonable levels. It looks like we'll be somewhat improved against last year, well off the historic norms that we saw in 2007 and 2006 especially. But a decent performance should give us, you know, 3.25, 3.50 At the gallon, it would seem to be reasonable. $4, I think, is out of the question under the current conditions.
You mentioned the high of $147 a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Back then, everybody was screaming speculators. They're the ones driving the market. That's what's happening. Where are they now? Have they just taken the day off?
Well, you know, I think you could make a very clear case that there's still speculators out in the market, and that's one of the reasons why we've come up from the $50 range into the $85 range.
So this is a little bit more psychology than economics, but is there a consumer confidence factor here? If we're basically happy and not going crazy spending money on gas and oil at $3.50 a barrel, does that control oil prices, or is it the other way around? Oil prices affect our behavior and our mood.
Oil prices will, you know, could potentially affect our behavior and our mood, but I think in the current market, it's really going to come the other way around. I think one of the reasons that you are up to $85 a barrel is an expectation of a pretty healthy recovery taking hold.
David Kirsch is the Director of Market Intelligence Services at PFC Energy out in Kansas City. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So here's something that might drive our demand for oil down, those new fuel efficiency standards the government announced today. By 2016, passenger cars sold here are going to have to get an average of 39 miles a gallon. For light trucks and SUVs, 30 mpg. Those new figures are about a 30% increase over the old ones. But as Brett Neely reports now from Washington, there may be some bumps on the road to higher mileage.
Today's new fuel efficiency rules mean small is beautiful, says Roland Huang at the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Those days of continuing escalating size of vehicles, bigger the better, those days are over.
Smaller cars are already more fuel efficient and cheaper to build, so car makers may switch their mix of models towards making more of them. That's one reason why Fiat took control of Chrysler. The government says new cars may cost about $1,000 more because of the new rules. But the numbers don't add up for David Cole at the Center for Automotive Research, which gets some industry funding.
When you look at the reality of the future powertrains, whether we're talking about plug-in hybrids, the battery technology you're looking at, really very, very high cost, certainly in the area of $3,000 to $5,000.
In addition to more expensive cars, there's another potential pothole for the auto industry, says Rebecca Lindland at the forecasting firm IHS Global Insight.
These kinds of fuel economy standards will push a lot of product onto the consumer that they don't really want.
She says what Americans think of as small isn't what the rest of the world thinks of as small. Drivers may have traded in their Hummers for something more modest, but Lindland says many won't squeeze into a subcompact just yet. That's not what the auto industry wants to hear as it ramps up production of smaller, cleaner cars. Gloria Bergquist is with the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers.
It's a real concern for automakers because we're investing millions and millions of dollars in these technologies.
She says the industry is willing to do its part by making more fuel-efficient cars, including new hybrids and electric cars. Now, it's up to consumers to buy them. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Still on cars for a bit, Toyota looks like it's doing pretty well as it tries to move past its recall problems. The company announced March sales this morning, up 41% from a year ago. Ford and General Motors did almost as well. Chrysler, not really so much. Sales there actually fell about 8% last month. They are promising consumer incentives to help them get their mojo back. Economists and analysts and the rest of us, too, are hoping tomorrow morning will be the day the labor market gets itself back in gear. The March unemployment figures come out at 8:30 Eastern time. But, you know, sometimes national numbers don't really paint the whole picture. A report from the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia shows that states are recovering at greatly different speeds out of this recession. From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
The Philly Fed looks at all 50 states every month. In the latest survey, it found about half the state economies are growing, mostly on the West Coast and in the Northeast. Interestingly, the one growing the fastest is the one that sunk the lowest, Michigan.
When the country catches a cold, Michigan gets pneumonia and tends to bounce back a little more quickly than the national average for the same kinds of reasons.
That's economist Paul Menchik at Michigan State University. He says the Great Lakes state is benefiting from government help for the auto industry and from its unique economy.
Well, manufacturing is more volatile, and that's coming back a little bit more quickly than maybe some other economies based less on manufacturing.
Like the ones in the Mountain West, many of them are now feeling a little bit of economic shrinkage. The worst of that is going on in West Virginia and Maryland. Richard Clinch is an economist at the University of Baltimore. He says most of the states that are growing the slowest now didn't fall as far during the recession.
There has not been a significant change in Maryland's core economy. But there's a finite amount of time you can continue to outperform the nation. So the slow national economy is just coming home to roost in Maryland.
Clinch says Maryland didn't even experience the 2001 recession. That wasn't the case this time. According to the Philly Fed, this was the first recession in decades experienced by all 50 states. But it seems recovery will be a state-by-state issue. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Traders managed to squeeze out a win on Wall Street today, but it was all downhill after a good start. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today's a very big day for high school seniors. Many of them are going to find out where they might be and where they are definitely not going to college. Plenty of rejoicing, lots of disappointment, and loads of parents coming face to face with the financial reality of higher education. Given the economy the past couple of years, there are a lot of seniors and their families who simply can't afford school right now. But a study out today shows that people least likely to go to college are the ones who do stand to gain the most. From the Marketplace Education Desk, Amy Scott reports.
A college graduate earns almost twice as much on average as someone with just a high school diploma. But the study out today says for students from disadvantaged backgrounds, a college degree can be even more valuable when it comes to income. UCLA professor Jenny Brand co-wrote the study in the American Sociological Review. She says low-income students whose parents maybe didn't go to college may be more motivated.
For people who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, they college really has to matter in terms of, you know, the economic payoff. You know, they have to overcome considerable odds to attend college, and it really has to pay off.
Brand says these students are more likely to major in business, for example. People from privileged backgrounds for whom college was a given might be more inclined to choose less lucrative fields like the social sciences. Brand based her conclusions on a study that followed a group of young people starting in 1979. Patrick Callen is president of the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education. He says a college degree is worth even more now than when the study began.
Used to be, if you didn't go to college, you know, you could go get a job in a factory, and if you belong to a union, buy a house in the suburbs and send your kids to college. That's not true anymore.
Callen says the study shows how important it is to make college more accessible and affordable. He says tuition at four-year public colleges went up 6.5% last year when median family income fell. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Consider for just a moment the tomato. A good one brings with it the very essence of summertime. A bad one can wreck an otherwise fabulous meal. Arthur Allen has spent the past couple of years in search of the perfect tomato. It's a tale he tells in his new book, Ripe. Since a studio interview about this seemed, well, kind of boring, we met up at the Pershing Square Farmers Market, just a couple of blocks from Marketplace World headquarters here in downtown L.A., and then we went tomato shopping.
Excuse me, where are these from, these tomatoes? So do you know what varieties they are, what they call? Custards?
All right, so we have these tomatoes we just bought. They are tomatoes that we see in the supermarket every day, tomatoes on the vine.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell me just by looking at these guys?
Well, they're smaller than sort of the traditional tomato, which means they're bred to be smaller because usually you get more flavor out of a smaller tomato. They have, just by pulling on them, I can tell, you know, the tomato doesn't come off the vine easily.
Right.
And the reason they do that, I mean, it's convenient for picking them. You slice off a bunch of them. And also, when you have this hole closed, you lose fewer of the volatiles. And the volatiles are the smell. And that's an incredibly important part of a really good tomato experience.
Well, what is it about Americans and tomatoes? I mean, it's sort of the quintessential thing, you know, that search for the good tomato in this country.
Yeah, I think because it's a symbol of everything that we think that we've lost, right? So we think, you know, tomatoes used to be better. They were always better. And now when you go to a supermarket, you can't get a good tomato. You know, nobody's tomatoes are like the ones I had in Greece or Thailand. When I was a kid or in Jersey, you know, or in South Carolina.
No, Jersey tomatoes? I don't know.
Jersey tomatoes. Oh, there are so many people who swear by Jersey tomatoes.
Just to be clear, the tomatoes that we see here at a farmer's market and the tomatoes that we see in the supermarket, even the hothouse ones that aren't, you know, those heirlooms and really great-looking ones, that is not the majority of the tomato crop in this country. Most of it is bundled and packed off and shipped en masse to tomato paste creators, right?
Close to two-thirds of all the tomatoes that are grown commercially in the United States are harvested with machines. They have thick skins. They ripen all at once. You can watch these harvesters pick them. They pick about a ton of tomatoes in about 20 seconds.
Oh.
They go onto these big gondolas, and they get shipped right to a cannery and turned into a paste within a couple of hours. So they're actually made into paste, you know, they're very fresh right from the field. And then they can be stored in these bins, which keep out contaminants, for 2 years.
That makes that can of Prego sauce all the less appealing, really, when you know that backstory.
It does. I mean, it makes it less appealing aesthetically. And what I explored a lot in this book is sort of what's the difference between what's aesthetically pleasing, sort of our idea of what a good tomato is, and what's actually, you know, a good tomato in terms of nutrition and things like this. And what's interesting is that, you know, the paste that goes into the Prego tomato sauce, there's science that shows that you're more likely to get the lycopene benefits from that paste than
that
you are
from the good stuff, right?
The good stuff,
yeah.
The antioxidants. Yeah. You get more of them from a slice of pizza than you're going to get from eating a couple of these tomatoes.
So if I take a bite out of this thing, and it's good, but you know what my first thought is? It needs a little salt. It needs something on it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
It's rare to find a tomato that you can just eat and have it be, in and of itself, a thing you want to eat more of.
Absolutely. And I mean, that's the point of all these people who've done all these things to convert tomatoes, you know, into something that's bred more for production than for flavor. They're saying, in the end, you know, the basic tomato flavor is what you need. The rest of it is going to come from salt and pepper and your oregano and the mozzarella cheese you serve in it with. And I think there's a lot to that. I mean, a tomato, in my book, a tomato needs friends.
Arthur Allen. His book is called Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. Arthur, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. See, this is really bland.
Oh, yeah. It's horribly bland.
Really bland.
Coming up, hoop dreams, if you got the grades.
The guys that we go after are the guys that have already screwed up. And so when we first get them in the door, it's like, hey, look, this is your second chance.
But first, let's do the numbers. No fooling around today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials put on 0.2%, about 70 points, closed at 10,927. The NASDAQ added 0.2%, 4 points, finished at 2,402. The S&P 500 took home 0.75%, that's 8 points. Ended the day at 11.78. Financial stocks had a mixed day. Citigroup deposited more than 3% today. Bank of America and J.P. Morgan Chase each added more than 1%. Morgan Stanley reversed 0.3%. Goldman Sachs gave back 0.25%. The soon-to-arrive iPad made its mark again today. Amazon was off close to 3% today on concerns its Kindle would lose the e-book battle to Apple. Barnes & Noble booked a 2% gain on hopes that the iPad would boost book sales all the way around. Apple shares rose 0.4%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.87%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering more young people to achieve educational success beyond high school.
Thank you.
Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to updates on the economy and business, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's going on tomorrow. The employment situation for March is released. Got questions on national employment and unemployment data? The Bureau of Labor Statistics holds its first ever live web chat. Things on Wall Street should be a little quiet. U.S. markets are closed in observance of Good Friday. And are things at Apple quiet? Probably not. Apple's iPad debuts on Saturday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank struck a blow against Washington's revolving door today. He publicly blasted a former staff member who quit to go work for the derivatives industry. Frank said nobody who's on his staff now can even talk to the guy. Before he went to work for Frank, by the way, the guy lobbied on Capitol Hill for the Bond Market Association. Point being that despite the financial crisis, the financial lobbying industry is doing just fine. So well, in fact, that commentator Mike Konzel says given the way the various reform bills are shaping up, the lobbying work is just about done.
The financial industry poured $500 million into lobbying lawmakers on the new financial reform bill. And it was money well spent. They derailed President Obama's idea of an independent agency to protect consumers from abusive financial products. Instead, a bureau at the Federal Reserve is supposed to protect consumers. By definition, these regulators worry more about banks than about families. And a separate council of bank regulators will be able to veto whatever that bureau does. This law doesn't limit the size of the largest banks or the types of risks they can take. Instead, that's left to reluctant regulators who won't want to take away the punch bowl while the party's going. President Obama wanted to adopt something called the Volcker Rule. Banks would have to stop taking the sorts of risks that almost toppled our system. And bank size would be capped against GDP. But that's not in the bill. Instead, regulators are supposed to study the proposal and then vote on it. These are the same Fed regulators that let banks take all kinds of risks in the first place. So there's no need to fear any real structural changes to the financial markets. As far as dismantling a failed bank, the industry will have to pay $50 billion into an SOS fund. But there's no way that kind of money will cover the real costs. And just how regulators would unwind a major bank is untested. That just emboldens the banks to keep taking financial risks while figuring taxpayers will pick up the tab. This legislation doesn't do the very thing it was supposed to, prevent another financial meltdown that takes us down with it. There's only one clear winner here, and that's the financial services industry. So their lobbyists can just say, eh, and go home.
Mike Konzel is a research fellow at the Roosevelt Institute in New York City. Take a minute to share your thoughts with us. You can do it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. College basketball season has come down to this weekend. Michigan State takes on Butler. West Virginia meets Duke Saturday in the Final Four. The championship game is Monday night in Indianapolis, sure to be watched by millions on television. Making the Final Four is every high school basketball player's dream come true. Players on hundreds of community college teams would love to make the jump and suit up for a Division I school as well, if they can make the grade. April Demboski reports.
It's the semifinals of the California Community College Championship Tournament. San Francisco City College forward Deron Sims muscles past the guards for San Bernardino Valley. He sprints under the basket for a pass, a mane of dreadlocks trailing after him. He leaps into the air and dunks the ball through the hoop. Sims played for a championship basketball team in high school, but his grades weren't good enough to make a Division I school.
A lot of players end up at a junior college. Either they didn't handle their business in the gym and on the court, or it was school-wise.
Adam DeQuisto is the assistant coach for San Francisco City. As a recruiting scout, he had his eye on Sims throughout his high school career in nearby Oakland.
The guys that we go after are the guys that have already screwed up. And so when we first get them in the door, it's like, hey, look, this is your second chance.
Sims graduates from San Francisco City College this spring, and he's hoping to land a full scholarship to a top four-year college. Between 1999 and 2002, nearly 9,000 junior college athletes transferred to Division I schools. Many of them got scholarships overseen by the NCAA. Depending on the school, those scholarships can total as much as $50,000 a year per player. But the number of community college transfers has been dropping since the NCAA launched a drive to improve the academic performance of college athletes.
Now, in Division I, you know, you can't recruit an at-risk junior college guy.
Philip Martin is an assistant coach for the Nebraska Cornhuskers. He's at the California Community College Tournament scouting potential players.
If he comes to our place and he's there a year and he drops out, then it takes a point from us. And if you fall below a certain average, then they start taking scholarships.
As part of its academic reforms, the NCAA stripped scholarships from 17 basketball teams in 2006. Last year, that number grew to nearly 40. Kevin Lennon is vice president for academic affairs at the NCAA.
Presidents and all other athletic administrators recognize that everyone is being held accountable for the academic performance of our students.
Community college players are paying the price for this new accountability. New research from the NCAA shows that only about half of two-year college basketball players earn their bachelor's degrees after transferring to a Division I school. Nebraska's Philip Martin says schools like his are taking fewer kids from community colleges to protect their scholarships.
You're rolling the dice, you know, on a lot of these kids, you know, but that's the nature of the business.
San Francisco. Deron Sims ended up scoring 12 points in San Francisco City's victory over San Bernardino Valley. His team went on to the finals against Saddleback College and lost. But Sims' play in the tournament sparked plenty of interest from recruiters, and they talked to him as much about his academic goals as his workout routine.
Well, a lot of the schools that I talk to, they see me play, but they ask about school more than anything. And that's kind of what I like about it. Because I don't want to feel like they're just using me. I want them to actually be there for me and be able to help me in school.
Sims hopes to hear something on the future of his basketball and academic career as soon as March Madness wraps up next week. I'm April Demboski from Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Citrix, offering Go to My PC, providing remote access to a Mac or a PC from anywhere. More at gotomypc.com/market. And by Putnam Investments, dedicated to helping financial advisors and their clients pursue a more comfortable retirement. You can get the latest at rothirablog.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, a caveat about tomorrow morning's unemployment report. It will come, as always, on the first Friday of the month. Sadly for stock traders, though, tomorrow also happens to be Good Friday, a holiday for the New York Stock Exchange and the other equity markets, which means if the labor report is unexpectedly good or unexpectedly bad, they will have no place to vent either their frustration or their enthusiasm, which means Monday might be a real interesting day in the markets. But we get ahead of ourselves. That's Marketplace for this Thursday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow put on 70 points, about 2/3%. NASDAQ added 4 points, 2/10%. The S&P 500 bumped up 8 points. That is 3/4%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow morning to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this broadcast, shopping malls gear up for the iPad rush.
For customer convenience, we actually put in some very high-end porta-potties.
Decorated with real flowers, no less. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. Kind of makes you want an iPad, doesn't it?
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.